I'd like to now introduce, we're very lucky to have Akbar Abbas, Professor of Comparative Literature at Hong Kong University and University of California, Irvine, and Alex Washburn, Chief Urban Designer, New York City Department of City Planning. Akbar Abbas, I think we all know from his fantastic book on Hong Kong and the culture, the culture of politics of disappearance, and where he looks at cinema, literature, and architecture at Hong Kong. He's a professor of comparative literature at Hong Kong University, professor of comparative literature at the University of California, Irvine. And he's also authored many other books on, and is a senior fellow at the India-China Institute, so we're welcoming him back to the new school. He comes here quite frequently. And a visiting professor at Parsons New School of Design. Alex Washburn, a Chief Urban Designer, City of New York, Department of City Planning, started that job just in 2006 under Amanda Burden's leadership. He received his Master's of Architecture from Harvard GSD in 1993, joined Capitol Hill staff and the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan in New York, covering issues of environmental, transportation, and federal architecture. He worked with Senator Moynihan and launched the effort to rebuild New York's legendary Penn Station and the Farley Post Office, an effort that continues today at City Planning. In 1996, he moved to New York and founded the Pennsylvania Station Redevelopment Corporation. I first met Alex as a practicing urban designer. His partnership, W Architecture, is a very interesting firm that combines landscape and architecture for urban design. But then he returned to government in 2006. So please, Alex and Akbar, will you come up to the, with Lawrence and Paul, come up to the table right here. We'll follow the program, and I'm going to ask Akbar to speak first, and then Alex.
Thank you, Brian. My wife always used to remind me that I'm just a Hong Kong boy. So at one point was to put down is my qualification for speaking today in this commentary. A few comments that I thought of. While coming here, what I'd like to do is connect some of this with what Paul and Lawrence said in this extremely interesting way, and I won't be able to, as it were, do justice to all the insights and observations, but I hope some of the things I say would connect in an interesting way with what they've just said. The first point I want to make would be this. This whole question of vertical density by accident or by design. And I think it's also something that sort of runs through the two presentations. There's, of course, a third possibility, which is that it could be a result of both together. In the sense that what looks like accident could, in fact, be design. And what looks like design can, in fact, be something that's a result of accident. In other words, I think there's a context, you might say, or a history of density that we have to take account of. But this history is, of course, not a chronological history. It's not a history of political or economic events, but more a history, you might say, of the spatial event, right, of spatial mutations as event. In other words, a kind of spatial history. And reading history, history of New York, history of Hong Kong, would be really also a question of reading spaces. I think as Lawrence was saying, you can have design without designers. And I think the one of the things that would allow that to happen is that there's always a spatial history behind what are the things that we are seeing. The second point I'd like to make would be, you know, how we read this this spatial history. How do we read Hong Kong or New York? And that's a good and ready example of spatial history. Of course, exactly, Poulhouse's Delirious New York, a book, by the way, that could only be written by someone who's not from New York. Because in this book, reading New York, as Poulhouse insists, is less a question of year than of day year. Right? It's not a question of just reading something rationally, but as looking at all the exaggerations. Because the spatial history that we're talking about, in all cases, I would say, is a history that cannot be observed directly. They're like black holes, in that they can only be observed in terms of its effects. For example, in terms of the exaggerated and excessive architecture that, for example, that you find in New York or Hong Kong, in terms of all the contradictions that you know, like down, you know, bottom-up approaches, top-down approaches, everything together and at the same time. It's in terms of, I think, some of these contradictions that that you can read the spatial history. And it's like saying that in Hong Kong, in New York, and today, of course, more and more in many Chinese cities, nothing is true except exaggerations. That's what they used to say about psychoanalysis. But I mean, that's a remark that's sort of becoming sort of more and more relevant today, I think. Which is why, it seems to me, facts and statistics alone cannot capture this spatial history. To just give an example, statistically, it's been pointed out many times already, Hong Kong has a huge proportion of green spaces and undeveloped areas. But this doesn't make it a green city, as these spaces are, as it were, leisure spaces. They function, as it were, a bit like Central Park in New York. So even though the statistics are different, right? Hong Kong, in spite of these statistics, feels, in fact, like New York City with an oversized Central Park. Right? I mean, that's what I feel. Even though you look at the statistics, you know, it's like 25% is developed, 75% is green. But it still feels like New York City in many different ways. Now, I think one of the things that our conference is challenging us with is this challenge of, this further challenge, not just of these two spatial histories, but challenging us to compare two very interesting and specific kinds of spatial history, which is what you, which is New York and Hong Kong, and comparing New York and Hong Kong in terms of vertical density. Seems to me, in order to do that, one of the things that you need to immediately take account of would be the different spatial histories. Again, if you use Poulhouse as a kind of starting point, right? Poulhouse speaks, you remember, of course, not of Manhattan, but what he calls Manhattanism, which is, of course, a spatial history that can only be retroactively constructed. Right? You don't know it's happening until it hits you later. So in other words, after we have observed the effects produced. So what I want to propose is whether we might speak then not of Hong Kong, but of a kind of Hong Kongism. Right? A Hong Kongism which would be like Manhattanism, you know, something that is not directly observable in spite of all the facts and figures that we have. Now, Manhattanism, as you remember, Poulhouse calls a culture of congestion. Right? It's but the provocative point he makes, and I want to use that to lead on to this whole question of Hong Kong. The provocative point he makes here is that congestion is not so much a problem to be solved as the forever insoluble problem that allows Manhattan to be built. In other words, congestion is what makes the apple big. So Manhattan's anti-grid design, therefore, is something that keeps asking to be filled. And I think this is the provocative sense of what he means by culture of congestion. Now, Hongkongism, we might try another formula, which I think I've used elsewhere. But we can talk about Hong Kong maybe as a culture of disappearance in a specific sense, right? Disappearance in terms of history as a colony, as a dependent city, as a, today as a Chinese city, in all these sort of avatars of the city, as it were, Hong Kong has always been threatened with disappearance. But then, of course, it is this disappearance is the insoluble problem that results not in doom and gloom, but always results in doom and bloom. Right? In other words, the worse things are, the more difficult things are, like the more, as it were, economic, social, cultural conditions bloom. Now, you have this paradox of, as it were, it's like a city that feeds on a crisis, that feeds on dependency and so on and so on. So, and throughout its history, what you see, of course, is a dependent city, right? Not so much, Hong Kong, as you know, right, is a city that's entirely dependent on its foreign connections, but also physically dependent on China for food and water. Right? So it's not as if at any point it can be an independent city. And from this point of view, right, it's never it's not so much a place, a site, as it is in a way always a parasite. Right? A parasite, it's something that besides something else. But then, you see, I think the interesting thing is that it's exactly this twist that Hong Kong gives to dependence and to disappearance and dependency that becomes the source of its freedom, that becomes the source of its vitality. And of course, a latent version of this use of dependency, this parasitic as a relationship to China, of course, is the former. One country, two systems. Right? Because one country, one way of looking at it is that you have a site, right? One country, two systems, and you have the parasite. Right? Mao used to, in this earthy language, used to talk about Hong Kong as a pimple on the backside of China, right? Which of course is, in a way, you know, geographically, all that it is. But then, of course, you know, the pimple and the parasite can turn around and bite and so on. And also the question of the harbor, right? There's all this lamentation about the harbor disappearing. But yeah, again, you see that it's the disappearing harbor, right? That the way in which, as it were, a city builds, that the city, as it were, to a certain extent, turns all these things that seem negative, like at one level congestion and another level disappearance, into something else. And so I think that this kind of spatial history might be a kind of one way in which we could sort of address the question of density. Now, I know that we will have to be commenting again later on after the second set of presentations, so I'll stop here and reserve some of my other remarks for later.
Well, I was impressed that both presentations ended essentially with a question mark. That question mark is something that you two both face, and it's also what we face in New York. Both Hong Kong and New York are growing despite the low birth rate. There's still a growth rate from what we understood from the secretary yesterday of about 1 million people by 2030. New York has that same issue. We're growing by about 1 million citizens in a time of very serious climate change. And we've taken a sort of an ecological approach that the mayor's put out, Plan YC, which is a series of 127 very specific programs about how to deal with this rapid population growth in a time of real stress on the environment. Most of the programs, recommendations are quite technical, quite specific. They range from congestion pricing as a way of raising money for infrastructure development to land use patterns favoring transit-oriented development, brownfields redevelopment, on and on in specificity for these specific efforts that will green the codes, that will make the city more sustainable. But underlying them all is, I think, something that could be critical for any growing city in the 21st century, which is sort of a new definition of civic virtue, that our success as a city is going to very much depend on our success in managing the environment in the 21st century. So there is a paradigm shift away from things like architecture, you know, like Corinthian columns. You know, if you wanted to show how much you cared and loved your city, you would never build a set of Corinthian columns today, even though, you know, just 100 years ago we did that for the Farley Post Office, which has the largest range of Corinthian columns in the Western world. But nowadays, if we want to show we love the city, if we want to leave it better than we find it, then we institute green networks. We're building bike lanes now by the scores of miles every month. We are thinking of things as pedestrian-connected infrastructure. Something like the High Line is a very good example of what New York is doing in this regard. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that project. Disused piece of infrastructure from the 1930s. It was about to be torn down so that the real estate interests that owned the land underneath it could build. Friends of the High Line was formed by two citizens, you know, not planning officials, not even architects, just two very concerned and creative citizens who instituted a whole program to save this infrastructure, convert it into a park. And then one of the early friends of the High Line was Amanda Bird, who ended up afterwards as planning chair. And with that and the support of the Bloomberg administration, rezoned the neighborhood in a manner that allowed development rights to be transferred off of this new park and onto the surrounding territory, therefore allowing densification, but only in the context of this superb new linear park elevated off the street, but continuous on the pedestrian realm. And I think that's, in some ways, the paradigm. In my job, where I have to be the chief urban designer, you know, we are given these tasks. You know, the deputy mayor says we need 5,000 units of housing over here. Well, you know, how are we going to do that? Is it Robert Moses? You know, I mean, that's the normal approach. That's the top-down approach. Okay, we need 5,000 units of housing. That's a lot of high-rises. But we don't want the Robert Moses approach only. You know, we love Jane Jacobs. Amanda is a pupil of Holly White. You know, we really think that the death and life of great American cities, the death and life of great vertical cities, we've got to value our streets. Everything happens in the street. You know, she called it the ballet of Hudson Street, but it applies to any street. And what you showed, that wonderful collage from Lee Tung Street, was a perfect example of that series of connections that happen at ground level among citizens. And it doesn't matter how expensive the fabric is, air conditioned, not air conditioned, high rise, low rise, but it's the street itself. So we spend a huge amount of time battling with developers who, in their sort of haste to put up the tower, are trying to get past the responsibility to the street that needs to be shown by every building. So we believe in blocks. We believe in how the tower meets the block, meets the street. And it's a remarkably complex streetscape. It is, in school, it seems so stupid to me. Those trash cans and benches and light poles. What's so difficult about that? But it's not. It's actually where all your theories of urbanism come together. You've got to make the street a lively place, and you have to get all these very pedestrian systems to match. And I think that's technically our biggest challenge, is how do we have towers come down and support the type of street where you'll see a cat in the window. You know, something where the grain becomes absolutely to the fineness that Jane Jacobs would have loved. So how do we get the quantity of Robert Moses with the quality of Jane Jacobs? And the only answer to the question mark that I can come up with is to look to another New Yorker, to look to Frederick Law Olmsted, you know, and not in the sense of designing another Central Park, but in the sense of trying to bring nature and green networks into every scale of every development that we do. And the High Line is an example of that. because it uses the Beam network to make, to revive a neighborhood to the degree of density that's, you know, adding thousands of housing units, but to the degree of finesse and complexity that Jane Jacobs would have wanted. So I'm hoping, I mean, we're banking a lot of this in New York, that in seeking a green future, we will marry those traditions and continue what I think urbanistically is our greatest, greatest asset, the continuity and vitality of our streets.
I have a question for the mic's on.
Yes.
Just, hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a question for the gentleman who was lecturing before Mr. Ahmed about Hong Kong. And the question is, how does Hong Kong addresses its worker housing, and basically how is that funded? I noticed that the property developers seem to understand the need for infrastructure. I'm quite sure that's written into the pro forma. But since Hong Kong has a huge influx of labor, how do they deal with that, and who's responsible for dealing with worker housing? Here in America, we don't leave that to the private sector.
You mean worker housing?
I mean housing for the people who can't afford the luxury houses. The worker housing. Housing for the people coming to do the grunt work in the city, not the investment bankers, not the people from the fire sector.
Are you talking about the working class?
The working class.
Working class.
How do you solve the issues?
50% of, 48, I think it's 48, the latest figure, 48% of Hong Kong's, of all housing stock in Hong Kong is run by the Housing Authority. It's actually a government body, and they build and develop their own properties.
One of the buildings he illustrated, there was a underground transportation node infrastructure. Do the developers take that upon themselves because they understand the need for that, or are they induced to taking on that?
Because
they would have to be induced here.
That's our next topic, so we're going to answer that with the next speakers.
Yeah. No, so it's like you're saying that on the surface, Hong Kong looks like a welfare state, even, you know, in some ways more developed than a welfare state, but this is a welfare state.
No, basically I was trying to figure out how is that taken care of, because here we place everything from the lens of cost. And I can't imagine us incurring those type of costs at the expense of the private sector without the government involvement.
No, it's a complicated issue, yeah.
Well, I think so far we haven't got a so-called workers' housing in Hong Kong. We have a public housing in Hong Kong, that's for sure. And public housing is something that a citizen who actually got a Hong Kong ID can apply for. It's not for the temporary workers coming to Hong Kong to work, and the who can apply. And more importantly, I would think that what you are trying to ask is actually where are those so-called lower social class of laborers living? Unfortunately, I find that during these few days, no speakers had actually talked about the cage housing in Hong Kong. Those are the most expensive kind of housing per unit square feet or square meter in Hong Kong. Those are actually something like the 1.5 meter times 2 meter cages, by which if you go to search from the internet, there's a cage housing movie in the early 90s, I would say. So those are the housing that I think you are asking for.
Yeah, I'm basically asking not where they, but how do you fund them? Because Hong Kong is an immense city, and I'm quite sure that it's not run by the elite class alone. There's tons of people who have to do the daily work. Where do they live? And I see you have a large amount of vertical housing, but who pays for that?
Right, they pay for themselves. That's the answer. The government is not subsidizing anybody for that. Am I right? I mean, there are so many in Hong Kong.
We've got the transit bus.
Thank you.
Question from Judge.
How is
how is Hong Kong dealing with what I can see a comparison to the city of Venice in Italy, which has actually turned into sort of the Disneyland of the lagoon, where, you know, I saw the very interesting slide that you had of the cities on the province, you know, in China, at the edge of that river, just waiting to either cross over the river into your protected world. And will this become the new Venice? In many ways, even New York City is falling into that category. Over Manhattan Island.
You mean a preserve zone?
It's a preserve, you know, core of wealth and sort of Disneyland. And then this world is surrounding it, you know, which is like Manhattan and also historically like Venice. Venice is a city which has, you know, the magistrate, the industrial core all around the lagoon, and the city got preserved in the center, but also issues of density. I mean, this was the first dense city. You know, you go there and there's points where the density was, you know, some of the highest in Italy. So, or in the world at that time. So how is that, how are you doing it, as well as the rest of the New York side also? Dealing with integrating that and with, you know, what's coming probably in the next 20 years in Hong Kong, and also what is happening in New York to deal with the same situation.
In New York, we try to follow a pattern of having the growth around transportation nodes. We've actually downzoned several neighborhoods as well as upzoned others. I think integrating the boroughs as much as possible is a key goal, and we really started getting some development outside of Manhattan. I'm a Brooklyn resident, so I don't know. I think there are many actually low density parts of New York City as well as high density, and where I live in Red Hook seems very far from Disneyland. So I don't really find that's the key on our agenda. I don't know if that's...
I think Hong Kong Island, if it plays its cards right, won't fall into that trap. But as Paul has shown you in his presentation, that some of those so-called real areas are gradually disappearing now. So with the loss of the real, we get closer and closer to Disneyland. But I don't think that will happen. Streets are actually disappearing as well, because a lot of our sites through comprehensive development are actually getting bigger and bigger. The plots are getting bigger and bigger, and the streets in between that actually used to be on these sites actually get bigger.
But why are you allowing superblocks? I mean, that's a key thing.
That's a question for the lands department.
We can write a letter and ask the lands department. There are a couple of rumors, actually. I read a couple of articles saying that before 1997, the plot ratio, well, actually, way back before 1997, when the British know that they have to go back home, actually, the plot ratio of certain lots really increased, because that will be their final romance. So, I mean, it's not proved, but anyways, that is actually something that has been advocated by some of those writers. But I just want to supplement one thing. The gentleman asked about the border condition, and actually, during lunch, right, we discussed that Hong Kong is actually being absorbed into a megalopolis condition, meaning that the Pearl River Delta is actually going to be a big megalopolis like London or New York, New York State, I would say. So it means that, you know, cities of Shenzhen and other Pearl River Delta cities are going to form a holistic core in the southern tip of China, instead of, you know, defining us by Hong Kong City. In the coming, I don't know, maybe 20 years. And then what is happening is that the restricted border, by which it is actually having 2,800 square kilometers, you know, which was once a prohibited area, by which you have to apply for special permit to go into that border between Hong Kong and Shenzhen because of the, you know, the prohibited trade for the weapons going back to the through China to, for the Korean War back in the 1950s. It's going to be open. I mean, the border is open. And now that 2,400 square hectare is going to be open for the, you know, for investment. So it seems that, I mean, if we try to take a look at a view from our side towards Shenzhen, we very quickly we discover that Hong Kong is underdeveloped. Mm. There are so many high-rise towers, you know, in the Shenzhen side, but, you know, only rural, you know, villages are shown in the in Hong Kong. So basically, it's actually starting to, I would say, to happen, but whether it's going to be a Disneyland or not, I just can't tell. But that is something that is happening. I mean, maybe at the end, maybe at some point, right, the CBD of Hong Kong will move from the Victoria Harbour towards the, you know, northern part of Hong Kong. I mean, that's a boat as a postulation. But
can I just ask one last question? I have a question for Akbar. Actually, I'm very interested in your, I know you've written a lot about the culture of disappearance, and I think it's very suitable that you frame your observations like that. But literally, I think when, you know, my slide that actually dealt with the disappearing border, literally, when that border goes, this so-called disappearance, do you think it's going to be metaphorical or it's actually going to be literal? Because I've actually been thinking about our literal disappearance.
Yes. Yeah, it's physical and literal, I would say.
No, I mean, it's like a quick answer. But sometimes you answer, you know, someone asks the question and you answer it, and then you ask, does that answer your question? And I think the answer to that is yes, it answers your question, but it begs another question. Right. So I mean, this sort of disappearance, the literal disappearance, can also link up with other, like, you know, the way things disappear, takes many different norms. Right? I mean, it could be, for example, the colonial city. It's the dependent, successful international city. Then it's this the new Chinese city. Mm. You know, I mean, but in Hong Kong, of course, as you know, always stories about Hong Kong until quite recently. It's always been stories about elsewhere. You know, like, where did you come from? Where are you going? Right? And the only moment when it changed was like in the 80s, under this threat of what was considered a real historical crisis, which is 1997, which then, you know, focused people's minds on what they have. I mean, this Hong Kong that they sort of took little account of, now suddenly became this important thing. So then you have all this identity politics that came to the fore, you know, that Hong Kong identity, blah, 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 right? Which no one ever cared about before that time. But you see, this is also the moment of something else, and we could talk about that next session.
Next time.
Which is, you know, Hong Kong comes back.